Welcome to the Talking Circle. Michael, you're not quite in a circle. Come on. Come on. Yes,
I know that reaction. Imagine that. I'm auditioning for the part.
Yeah. So good to see so many familiar faces and such a packed out audience. I probably can't take any credit for that. That's all you're doing.
Oh, come
so
on.
Thank you. I hope you're getting something treated well for supporting me, Michael.
Glad to be here.
We go back nearly 10 years.
Yes.
Not that we've been in constant contact, but you know, your distant claim to fame.
Yeah.
And I haven't even introduced you properly, Michael, but you are Sir.
Well.
Michael Palin.
I am.
Yeah.
And I'm 5'11" and a half. And I weigh 75 kilos.
And you are best known for your role as the narrator in The Clangers. Is that right?
Yes. Well, you've got that right. It's my favourite job. Absolutely the best job. I love The Clangers. Very honoured to be the voice. And all I had to do was go sit in the studio for 60 hours.
I only know that because my little boy, who you saw at the end of the, well, he wasn't here, but my son, we were fans of CBeebies, and really? We used to hear your voice.
Oh, that is wonderful. That's very touching. I feel a real connection with the evening.
So you've literally touched like every generation, had an influence on every generation.
Well, I'm running out of generations now.
So I thought I'd just come to you and ask you, you know, how you feel after watching that.
Well, I thought it was the most extraordinary piece of theatre. Really powerful, inspiring. I didn't quite know what to expect, but I think that the combination of the writing, your story, the performances were absolutely brilliant. The design, the set, the direction, the lighting, sound, everything sort of came together. I was absolutely gripped throughout and very, as somebody said, emotional, very, very emotional. And it does feel as though there's a real sort of commitment in this production. It's very personal because they know it's your story. It's very much about Nottingham, which I think is important. So it pins it down to a reality, which is Nottingham life and the story that's gone on. And I don't think it lets you escape. It doesn't let you sort of idealize at any point. It tells how tough it is. It tells how difficult it is. And at the end, it's very, very nice. But it ends optimistically, but there are a lot of questions asked along the way, and I thought that was really, really important.
Yeah, I think that's a big theme that we try to get across in the show, is the questions.
Yeah.
And how important being curious enough and having the courage to ask those tough questions, because sometimes it's easy to just stay silent.
I think that restorative justice, which I'm very interested in, and I have the honour to be a patron of Remedy, actually, is just one of those really, really important things that should be easy. It should be done as a matter of course, but of course it isn't. It's very, very difficult. There are just various associations which came to my mind. My wife was a bereavement counsellor, and she talked to people, and she said, in the end, it wasn't really, the hurt was not about the grieving. The problem was that people had not sorted out their anger before the person had died. So there's a lot bottled up, and that would never be sorted out. Now it was too late to do that. So I thought what was good about the story is that this is a good story because you're able to work it out. Yeah. You're able to see the reaction. You're able to see that it can be done. And I I've got lots of questions to ask you, but I think that it's all a question of time and patience, isn't it? It's not just something which we can sort of click your fingers and say, right, that's, we're going to sort this out. And people don't talk to each other very well. And I think it's getting more difficult these days for a generation that sort of expect things to come through on the internet to form their opinions and all that. And this is very much about real life. and what it actually means to forgive somebody or not forgive somebody, but to deal with the business of forgiveness. I do hope that people seeing this play will realize, you know, that restorative justice is something that works. It can be inspirational, but it can take time. It can be very difficult, and it doesn't always, I'm sure, as you know, have the right outcome. But it's something I feel we should really, really be trying to do.
Yeah, couldn't have said it better than myself, Michael.
And you're a criminologist.
Yeah, and I campaign on this stuff. So I'll just hand the baton over to you.
Well,
and, you know,
it's great that your story has been told as well as it has this afternoon.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I first heard about you in 2015. You'd been on my radar, you know, slightly before for other reasons, but I was a Longford Trust scholar. For anybody that doesn't know, the Longford Trust is a charity that helps people go back to university that have been in prison. And every year they have an annual lecture.
Yeah.
And the Longford Trust were like, oh, we've got Michael Palin doing his our annual lecture this year.
Surprise.
Can you come and help Michael with some R&D research? I was like, okay. And I wasn't sure 100% what you were going to be looking into, but I think you were very brave to go where you did, actually, because you wanted to investigate the impact on the perpetrators' families.
Yes.
And you gave a lecture on that.
Yeah, that's right. And I called my lecture Collateral Damage, because it was all about focusing on the people who are quite innocent and yet were drawn in to through stigma by association. Mm. And I thought your story, we had a good chat about it, and I liked your openness and all that. You said to me, which I was quite struck by, was that what happened after the event, after, you know, you'd thrown the punch and all that, institutionally and through the system, you were rather let down, and certainly your mother was let down. They weren't told things, they weren't given information. Can you just tell me a little bit about that? Because, I mean, I know you deal with it in the play, and your mother dies, and that's dealt with very powerfully. But I think for the reason, perhaps you would say at one stage, she had all the problems was because she was let down by the system. She was not helped by a system that could, if it had worked, helped her, and she might still be alive.
You know, one of the last words she said to me was, please, Jacob, don't blame yourself for my actions. Right. Because, you know, she suffered with alcoholism, which all the stuff that happened to me kind of contributed to her becoming more dependent on alcoholism. She was she was functioning, as we all are functioning in some way. I say that we all have one bad habit. Mm-hmm. As long as we keep it at one, we'll be all right. Mm. It's when you add two, three, or four,
three.
That we start running into problems. But she stopped functioning, and she was a childminder, and that's the only job she'd known. And she brought up lots of kids in the meadows. And, you know, we used to have kids coming into the house. And on the first day or the first couple of weeks, they'd be coming in. I remember, because as I got a bit older, as a teenager, I'd see all the young kids that she was looking after. And the first few days, they'd all be coming in, oh, fucking hell, sticking their fingers up and that.
Yeah.
And then by the time, like, they got to secondary school, like, they'd become like, learn the manners, and, you know, like she did, like turn a lot of kids around.
Yeah, so she turned, she'd help,
and she'd like help turn them around, and, you know, teach them a new language. You know, many of us will know, you know, we find change hard, whether that's going to prison or whether that's losing your job. And yeah, she lost her job and that stability, and went into renting, and kind of just spiraled out of control really quickly.
Yeah, but she lost her job. I mean, that must have hurt her a lot, and taking some pride away.
Yeah, taking that sense of pride away, and that kind of, you know, it wasn't her fault that she had me living in the house, and then just the general kind of stigma of just feeling like, oh, how can you bring up, even if people weren't asking the question, we all have that kind of inner voice, don't we? That's, what do people think of me? you know, my son, you know, did this thing. And people saying to her, you brought up a killer and, you know, all these other things. And that would have...
I mean, this must have come from very... obviously, I think you deal well, very well when we've talked about the social stigma, about the way... you know, people in the street will shun her or you or ever, you know, killer's mother and all that sort of thing. But also things weren't made very easy for her by the system. Nobody really helped her in that first time. And I think, I mean, talking to you, the police just came round and said, you know, your son's killed somebody. It was quite a while afterwards before she was even sort of brought in. And then she wasn't allowed to sort of speak to you.
Yeah, wasn't allowed to speak to me. Guilty by association, almost, the way that there wasn't the same amount of care from the police. In terms of, I know in the play, and I don't want to call Joan out, but she is his. But in the play, Joan talks about victim liaison officers being assigned to people, rightly so, for in those situations, but them not necessarily being that supportive. For my mum, I think, you know, they might not have been supportive, but it still would have been helpful if there was someone somewhere that could talk her through the process of, you know, what's going to happen to your son now, you know, you might lose your job, you know, just talk her through the process in terms, because she didn't have any knowledge of the criminal justice system either, or and she didn't drive. There's just little things like she didn't drive. So as a kid, we used to, you know, all those references to trips to Clumber Park or White Post Farm or wherever it was, or to the Panto. Yeah, it was always a bus. And so she never learned to drive. So her visiting Glen Parva, even though it was Leicestershire, you know, it was just very difficult. You know, no one could bring her to come and see me, and she didn't have any money. So it's just, and one of the biggest things for people reintegrating back into the community is about family attachment and family bonds and pro-social connections to people in the community. And if you get, I had already kind of drifted off into unhealthy friendship groups and being a bit lost. And I think it's important to keep the family connected if possible.
I got involved through my interest in how I visited various prisons. And I just thought the people inside the prison, I mean, all right, you know, they've got to be punished, but that's a very, you know, sort of short, it's less important than being sort of brought back to mainstream life. Yeah. And that means talking to them and learning about them, learning about things, giving them opportunities to, so there's life afterwards and all that. And a lot of that I found was done through families, and I became interested in Action for Prisoners' Families, a very small support group, but it was mainly run by prisoners' families who were trying to address all these things about how difficult it is when someone's in prison a long way away. You can't get to see them. If you can't get to see them, you can't then, you know, work with them to help them later on. And it's just the figures are extraordinary about the number of people who, if they keep the family connection whilst they're in prison, they will be far, far less likely, I think it's something like 40% less likely to reoffend than if the family is broken, and then, you know, you're really on the downhill slope and you go back to reoffending and all that. So the family is very, very important. And I think it's good in the play, really, to look at all the family backgrounds and all that. Sometimes difficult, sometimes awkward, but, you know, they were there.
Yeah. What was it? Because it's not necessarily, it's not a vote winner, you know, being, caring about offenders' families or criminal justice matters in general, you know, isn't necessarily the most righteous of things to be inquisitive
prison,
about.
Prison generally is a bit turn off for most voters. They say, well, get on with it. And we all know it's horrendous what's happening in most prisons, but we're allowed to let that happen. Sorry.
But what was it specifically that kind of first drew you to that arena and being, I guess, objective enough to kind of learn more about it as opposed to...
Well, I suppose I'd visited one or two prisons, and I'd given talks about travels and all that sort of thing. And I saw it as a real challenge to try and get people to engage with me and there'd be a group of maybe 10 guys or something like that in a prison, and I'd be introduced, and they say, you've got 30 minutes, blah, and off they go. And to start with, most of them didn't even look me in the eye. And I thought, this is, you know, this is odd. If you're talking to people anywhere else, yeah, they weren't in prison, they at least they might be yawning, but they've had their eyes on you. in this particular case, they're all looking down, and I gradually was able to win them over in about half an hour. Not all of them, one or two just got up and left. I thought, what else have we got to do? but the others, I felt I'd got through, and you just know then. And at the end, one or two just came up to me and carry on the conversation. It was relaxed. It was like you were talking to people, you know, human beings.
Yeah.
That was the thing. So I think when the prisoners' families group came to me and said, would I be interested in just sort of speaking out for them or meeting up for them? I met up with them, actually. And they raised these various issues about families. And as I've said earlier, the importance of the family throughout this is absolutely vital. Once the family link is completely broken, then, you know, people are on the downward spiral. Keeping families together or making authorities and people involved in the justice system aware of the importance of families, and it is low on the agenda, as you absolutely say, but it should be high on their on their conscience.
One thing that I have been focused on a lot now is the family, and it is relationships.
Yeah,
and how do we get people having healthier relationships?
Yeah.
But not just, I guess it's Mental Health Week, and, you know, the quality of the relationships that we have with other people and how good we are at resolving conflict as opposed to escalating it. I feel like we're very good at escalating.
Mm.
But also the relationships that we have with ourselves as in return. And hopefully this show shines a light on that as well, in terms of the personal journey and those with others.
I think it's really good. It shows your transformation, because there's quite a lot in the first half where you're just a rather nasty lad, you know, kind of going around there, just shouting at people and going traveling with the gang and all that. And I think that's very, very good. It's not making you into a saint, because you're not a saint.
None of us are
saints. Exactly. That possibility of transformation, and I think it's a very tricky thing to do. I've seen it done before, and it's a little bit easy, and you don't kind of, you see, oh, they've just jumped something there in order to make a happy ending. This, throughout, I felt it was developing exactly the right pace, and you understood what was going on each time, and you understood the reluctance of people to talk. And James Graham, he writes this wonderful dialogue, which sometimes is completely broken. People who start sentences and can't finish them and all that.
Yeah.
I think that's really good. I think it says an awful lot about the feelings of the people involved. And I mean, he's done an absolutely fantastic job.
Yeah. And I think that's the difference between the two acts.
Yeah.
It's a person who...
Wild,
but wild because he didn't have the language.
Yeah, yes.
To express himself.
That's interesting. Yes,
and he didn't have the relationships where he felt he could be vulnerable, especially for men.
Yeah,
I believe that, you know, the big issue for men is that we're not comfortable being vulnerable, and I'm one of those people now. I'll have a good cry.
Yeah,
you know, quite a few times.
I'm sure lots of people did this afternoon. I mean,
hopefully, you've all
tissues were passed around.
Had a nice little cry.
Yeah,
I always feel good after a cry. But it's just, you know, that's what we want to get across, is that, you know, there's power in being vulnerable and connecting with your emotions. And as I started to learn the importance of that in the second act and through meeting David and Joan, I was like, wow, I was hurt. The reason I was the way I was is because I was hurt and I didn't have the words to express myself. I didn't trust anybody and I didn't know how to be vulnerable. And that's what restorative justice did for me. And then I just built from there.
I think, you know, David's story too is good, because he ultimately, you get onto the thing of forgiveness, which I think is a very powerful ending. But he's come a long, long way, you know. I think if you feel he's someone who just, his gut instinct is, you killed my son, that's it, end of story.
Yeah.
And the fact this gradually breaks down and you see other people talking to him. And I mean, it must have taken a long period, all this. So we're just seeing it in 2 hours. But how How long would you say the whole process was from the moment of James's, you threw the punch until you got together with the parents and shook hands?
I threw the punch in 2011. Got out of custody, that's true, by the way, New Year's Eve, 2012. And then we got in touch with each other. They made the inquiry about whether I wanted to speak to them, 2013, and then we met in 2015. So we had once I was out of custody, we were speaking for 2.5 years. And then when I got a place at university, they felt comfortable meeting with me and holding me accountable, Joan says.
Yeah.
Quite often, we welcomed you into the lion's den. Yes, and I can tell you, it definitely felt like the lion's den, but I needed to hear that stuff, because the other issue and point of the play is that we can all walk around from our own point of view, because that's all we have, right? But we start with the power of restorative justice, is it allows you to really put yourself in someone else's shoes.
Yes.
And you can't be ignorant anymore.
Yeah, no, that's right, yeah. And that, I mean, that process has to be carefully and patiently gone through, hasn't it? There could have been points between 2011, 2015, or whatever, where it just broke down. I mean, you must be aware. Did that happen to you? Were there times when you thought this is never going to work out? You're never going to resolve it, you feel?
Because what ended up happening with me is that I went through the restorative justice process, and then I was like, how have these people been able to facilitate this conversation between us? Yes. In a way where it felt like we was all moving at the right pace. We all felt safe, even though we're having difficult conversations. We're all moving towards, you know, repairing the harm or healing, however you want to say it, identifying what our needs were and how we're going to get those needs met and how we're going to make this process helpful. I was like, how have they done that? They must be like magicians, right? And because, you know, as you can see, I was useless at trying to have conversations. So I was like,
well, up to a point.
To a point. And I was like, these are the skills I need. I want to learn how to facilitate conversations. Mm-mm. I want to learn how to resolve conflict. Because I was like, that's probably one of the most important skills to have long term if I was going to stay out of trouble. And so I went on the journey of getting, you know, you've got Huey here in the front row. He helped me when I came out of prison. He got me to come and do my first public speech at a restorative justice conference. And I just continued to learn those skills. I was like, okay, what is it about this? I need to learn how to express myself. They're the most important skills. Emotional intelligence. We don't put enough importance on emotional intelligence in school. In school, it's all about memory test. How much information can you recall at the end of the year? And then we'll judge you on how good you are as a human being, how intelligent you are. And a lot of the work I do now in schools is about how teachers can support young people to express themselves better, and how I can help young people and older generations express themselves better and find a language that works for them too.
Hard task, but I mean, it's going to schools, I think, is very, very important, because you get minds which are not already set on any particular course. And I think that's very good, amazingly good that you do that. But, you know, but you've got an extraordinary story to tell, and you tell the full story, and you say that you killed somebody. And so that I think gives it a tremendous amount of strength. It's not a theoretical situation you're dealing with, an actual situation that happened. And the fact that you can now talk to, you know, the mother, and I just, Joan, I met her earlier, you know, absolutely lovely lady. The fact that you two can talk, I think it's just brilliant. Sorry, I got a bit emotional. There you go, pass the tissue.
I'm conscious of time. We could keep going for a long time.
Many years.
Many years. And maybe I'll get you on the podcast now you've agreed to talk to me for many years.
Oh, don't agree to the podcast? Hang on. Not so fast.
And then we'll write a book together, and then we'll go Jacob, traveling together. Yeah. No, Jacob.
Yeah. I'm 81, so you better hurry up.
But I thought it would be good for some of the audience to be able to ask some questions in the last 10 minutes of the time we have. If anybody, yeah, it's difficult to see.
Do you want the audience lighting up perhaps a bit or what?
The question, in case nobody heard it, was how well publicised is the restorative justice process in terms of in probation, in police, in everywhere else? And the answer is not well enough. Take up is very low, and not everybody knows what it is, never mind how it could benefit them. And so we're on a mission to make sure that everybody knows that they have the right to take part in restorative justice. It's part of the victim's code, but it's not been turned into a statute yet. So it's not compulsory for everybody to know and be told that it's there. It's just recommended that all victims of crime should be known about it, but that creates a massive loophole in terms of whether they actually are told that it exists and that it's a right of theirs. And I think we have this kind of assumption, especially within those parts of our criminal justice system where we know what victims want and we know what victims need. And often we take the power away from people who've been harmed, you know, that we should give the power back to them, give them a voice and let them talk about what it is that they need from the criminal justice system. Because lots of the time they don't feel like they've been heard. They don't feel like they've been seen. The police gather evidence, present that to the Crown Prosecution Service. They put that in court. They slam the hammer and you're jumping through all these different parts of the criminal justice system and the victims aren't being brought along. They're not being talked to throughout. And then when justice is done and the sentence is handed down, it's like, okay, move on now. And it's like, well, that didn't answer any of the questions that I've got.
Which is why I think this play is important. I mean, it's just a little acorn, but something will grow from it. Anyone who sees this, and I hope as many people as possible see it, not just here in Nottingham, but everywhere, will realise that you know, what restorative justice means personally to people in an actual situation, case. And very difficult to just explain it to people totally theoretically.
Yeah.
But this, there's real pain in this play and all that. And I think that's, and there is a solution in the end, a sort of solution. And I think that's really important for people to know that.
Yeah. And we'll move to the next question, but thank you for that.
Front row, very vocal today.
Yeah. Does RJ always start with the victim or does it ever begin with the perpetrator? It usually does begin with the victim because it's usually victim-led. If they've got a good victim liaison officer or they've got people who know about restorative justice, they'll make them aware of it as a right and say, have you ever considered this? And then they might pursue it and say, okay, I want to contact the person who burgled me or assaulted me or whatever it might be. And I want to ask them some questions. Obviously, it's a voluntary process. So it's then about speaking to that other person and seeing whether they're willing to engage in the conversation. The reason it's mainly more victim-led is because I don't think, although lots of perpetrators on the surface don't look very remorseful. Deep down, a lot of people feel shameful about what they've done, but the way that we respond to shame is to deflect it, which looks like people don't care, but deep down they do, but they just have no way of being able to connect with that. But restorative justice is one way where people can actually know how they've impacted other people. But because otherwise you're just imagining the harm. I used to, that scene with my mum when she says, I was talking about Joan. Oh, I didn't know who Joan was at that time. And how could I possibly try to imagine the pain of someone that I'm just trying to imagine? And so it was too difficult to think about. And I think what restorative justice allows is for people to actually think about it and actually hear the truth about what it is. And the harm
again, you know, just this, it can't be hurried.
Yeah.
And you should never take no for an answer, you know, because people are just going to say instantly at a certain point, no, not doing that. And then just got to say, well, let's leave it a while. They come back to it. I think to be given a second or third chance is, I would imagine, something very beneficial to the people involved, because you do change your mind. And if there's a good side to you, and there's a good side to most people, then, you know, you need time to bring it out and think about it.
Yeah. I think my character says in the first act, when he's on the night out, it says timing is everything.
Yeah.
And it's the same with restorative justice as well. It's leaving that door open so that, you know, there might be a time when you're feeling like you have a better understanding of the questions you want to ask, when it's a bit less raw, or when you've processed it a little bit.
Yeah, I've just wanted to ask you, have you, as a result of doing this and opening up about your experiences, have you had a lot of other people who have been sort of involved in restorative justice as perpetrators or victims come to contact you? Is it something that's sort of spread around?
Yeah, I've got a fairly strange network of friends and people who have been affected by crime. I know a lot of other young men who have committed one punch.
Right. Okay,
I know a lot of fairly few people who've committed manslaughter, and there's like a little group of people who talk about the shame of living with the guilt for the various different reasons, driving offences and all sorts of things. Other mothers, because I'm an anti-violence campaigner, it's usually anti-violence campaigners are from the people who have been harmed side, mm-mm, as opposed to those that have caused the harm. So I've just generally met a lot of mums who are passionate about spreading the message.
So it is sort of, it's rippling out.
It's rippling out.
And then I agree with the speaker, you want a sort of major boost in recognition of what's happening. Yeah. Yeah, what you're saying is the social stigma continues after you've finished your sentence. If you finish your sentence, you're a free man or woman.
Yeah, it is. And but it starts much earlier than when you come out of prison. It starts, for me, it starts in school. And that's what we don't get much time on stage to explore that aspect of it. But it's, you know, you are a naughty boy when you're a kid, and then you're a bad child. And then you get put in isolation in school, and then you get excluded from school. And then all of these interactions are, every time you have an interaction with somebody and they kind of shame you and they tell you that you're a bad person and that you're not very worthy and that you're what I used to get called thick or not very intelligent, is that you take it on and slowly we all have it in a dialogue. We all have it in a narrative that we're weaving together as storytellers. Eventually, we all believe our own stories, right, of who we are and what we're capable of. I had to go through restorative justice and rewrite a whole new narrative as to what I was capable of and who I wanted to be, and then go and find the people that I needed to find to kind of create that new identity almost. But it's very hard to be able to let go and step outside your comfort zone from all your old friends and everyone else in the hope that there's an alternative life that's worth living. I'd say restorative justice was the thing that started that journey for me and gave me the faith in exploring a different way.
Okay.
Good.
Ring class.
I don't know how many more we can do. Yesterday we both just had the mics cut. Maybe we should just ask a couple more and see if we get cancelled. We have one more here.
One more.
How's my brother doing? He's I'm very, very proud of him. Yeah. He's how much of his personal information should I disclose? what I would say though, he's still a gay prick.
applauding.
Round of applause to Joan. Without them, none of this would ever have happened.
No, exactly.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you for giving me the chance to come up here.
Thank you, Matt. That's it for season one of Right From Wrong. I hope you got something out of my story. In future seasons, I hope to explore some of the deeper themes from season one. Please reach me on my social media platforms at Jacob Freeman with three E's to let me know what future topics you'd like exploring and what guests you'd like me to be in conversation with. This podcast, along with the play and my book, have all been milestones in using my story to inspire positive dialogue around repairing relationships, reforming the justice system, and promoting the restorative process, which encourages accountability and compassion. This is just the beginning. Right From Wrong isn't a podcast, it's a movement. We're taking these ideas into schools, prisons, parliament, and beyond. If you feel the processes you've heard about in this podcast can be useful to you, please don't hesitate to get in touch. This podcast was produced by One Fine Play. Matt Cheney is series producer. Kazra Ferruzia is the editor and writer. Thanks also to Selena Christofides for help with the visuals. I have been your host, Jacob Dunn, and this is Right From Wrong.